It's something that's signalling that things are wrong. And it's not just at a small scale, it's at a very large scale. And, of course, other things also happen as the temperature goes up on the planet. And one of these is a rising sea level. So, again, we can see in the curve on the left annual sea level change. And from 1880 to 1990s, it's clearly been going up quite significantly. And the scenarios are that it will continue to go up. And I'll give you some data later that will scare you even more than what's showing now, because since this was the graphs were done, the work has gotten much worse. And, of course, climate change will bring great environmental changes as well. I mean, everything from food insecurity, because, of course, agriculture will be upset all around the world, to water shortages, because in many places, water supplies depend on snowfall and so on and so forth, and rainfall patterns are going to change. Some areas may do better, others will certainly do worse. We may see social stresses and chains of terrorism and refugees of various sorts, natural economic social disasters, loss of biodiversity at a large scale. This is not, in fact, climate change itself, but what happens when you do make... Sorry, that's the Aral Sea, and we may see more ships in the desert. And these are not camels. These are real ships in the desert as a result of what's going to be happening in the years ahead. So just looking at, say, food security. Again, you know, the scenarios looking at the future suggests that, well, the rich countries can probably adapt agriculture. They can afford to invest in changing the crops and changing the techniques and keep their food production. Climate change effects would damage food production to some extent, but they can probably adapt. But if you look at the developing countries, on all the scenarios, the impacts are going to be a severe decline in food production where they can afford it the least. And so you can imagine what that will do to the stability of the world system when you have that level of problems of food supply. Looking at biodiversity is one example. In America, they calculated that the beech trees, the beech forests of the south and the central part of the United States would, under climate change, move to middle or northern Canada, and they're no longer able to grow. So this really means that whole ecosystems are going to shift over very long distances. Things will no longer grow where they grow now, and may find some way of growing somewhere else, so they can get there in time. Of course, in the past, these changes took hundreds of thousands and thousands of years, and there was time for the seeds of the trees to be blown a few meters north, and then those trees grow, and then blown a few meters north. They had time to move. But trees can't get up and run to find a new temperature. Birds may be able to fly, animals can crawl, trees have more of a difficulty. So are we going to have to carry the seeds ourselves and plant the trees in the new areas? And what is going to be involved in shifts at this magnitude that may be coming in the years ahead? And, of course, there are also impacts on human beings from climate change. There will be certainly an increase in extreme weather events, more floods, more droughts, more cyclones. In many places, there will be less winter snowfall, melting glaciers, and therefore water shortages. Because many places depend. California depends on the snowpack in the Sierra Nevadas. Switzerland depends on the snow that falls in the Alps. And so many places may find that they will have some significant water shortages. And as I mentioned, agriculture will change. Already they see fish stocks in the North Sea moving. Fish that used to catch them there are no longer found there. They're occurring further down and so on. So the major displacements are going to take place and will continue to take place. And, of course, with rising sea levels, we see a lot of flooding of low-lying areas. Whole nations will disappear. Tuvalu, the Marshall Islands, the Maldives, small atoll countries where the highest elevation is 1.5 meters or 2 meters above sea level. It doesn't take very much sea level rise before you lose your national territory. And so, and almost many highly populated areas as well. Well, not to mention significant port facilities. How long will the Thames Barrier resist rising sea level? And what will happen to London when it doesn't? This is something that's going to affect everybody. And, of course, the result will be millions of environmental refugees will have to go somewhere else. But where will they go? Under what conditions? The implications of ship population shift at this level in our present system of frontiers and visas and so on and so forth may become totally intolerable in the years ahead. And, of course, it would be extremely expensive economically to mitigate climate change or to adapt to it. And the greatest impact is on the poor. The rich could always afford to go somewhere else to do something. The poor are the ones who suffer the most. So the implications of this will be quite phenomenal in the decades ahead. So this is one example. you know, the projections for Bangladesh, major parts of the coastal areas would displace 17 million people. Just, you know, for a moderate sea level rise over the next 100 years, perhaps, affecting 22,000 square kilometers, or 60% of the whole country. The Nile Delta would go the same way, and many other low-lying areas that are also vulnerable to even a moderate level of sea level rise. And I was just reading a couple of weeks ago that if we destabilize Greenland, which looks like now it may not be possible, because things are happening there that in the last two or three years that are quite frightening, if we lose the Greenland ice sheet, it would raise the sea level more than 6 meters. So that's 1.5 meters. So you can imagine what this would mean about where you should be, you know, shopping for your future beachfront property, you're planning for your children's, you know, vacation site or whatever. And of course, the economic impact of this is considerable. So that here you have, you know, the costs, insured and uninsured, of the major flood and weather catastrophe of the last 40 years. That was to 1997. And it was about that time, or a little bit later, that the United Nations, with the Swiss Re and Munich Re, were trying to calculate what are the economic risks of climate change-related disasters for the insurance industry. And they estimated that it might be $130 billion a year within 10 years annually from climate change. And these are hard-headed business people looking at their risks. However, last year, Katrina and Rita already cost $204 billion, just two events, doubling the previous record, you know, in 1998. Three of the 10 strongest storms ever recorded occurred in 2005. So there are warning signs here of the economic cost of ignoring climate change and doing nothing about it, saying everything is fine. We can't afford to adapt or adjust. Can we afford not to adapt, you know, not to do something about climate change? These are calculations that need to be made, because when we begin to add up all the different kinds of costs that may be involved in these changes global, it could be, you know, quite phenomenal in terms of what it means for our present economy and our present society. And if you think that that already looks bad, the latest evidence in the last two or three years suggests that the worst predictions of the ecologists may have been conservative. The Gulf Stream, which is keeping you all nice and warm here, has recently slowed by 30%. We don't know yet if it's going to be a long-term thing, but they have measured its slowdown, and it's turning south. Half of the permafrost in the Arctic is expected to melt by 2050, and 90% before 2100. And we know that there are enormous reserves of methane in the bogs that were frozen in that permafrost, you know, since the last, you know, ice ages. And methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas. And if it starts coming out, that develops a sort of positive effect that sort of creates even more global warming as a result. So it can be quite threatening. Last year, for the first time, you could navigate all the way across northern Siberia. And the oil companies are already saying, oh boy, by 2050, we can be drilling in the middle of the Arctic Ocean for the oil that we know is underneath. So they're already expecting ice-free Arctic in the decades ahead. The Greenland glaciers have doubled their rate of flow in the last 3 years. And the rate of sea level rise, which used to be about a millimeter a year, over the last 50 years increased to 2 millimeters a year. And the West Antarctic ice sheet has suddenly started melting against all expectations and is now adding about 4 millimeters a year to that rise. Greenland is adding, you know, 0.6 millimeters a year. So you're beginning to see how much the ocean is going up year by year, and suddenly the Thames Barrier doesn't look so secure after all. So we could easily point reaching a tipping point within the next few decades at which we get a kind of irreversible and snowballing process of climate change. And if the Gulf Stream slows or stops, northern Europe may cool significantly. I think they're talking about maybe a 7-degree drop on average, and something of this sort. Doesn't look very pleasant. And what will this do to agriculture? What will it do to your heating bills? Other things. And of course, all of this process is driven by our addiction to cheap energy, mostly from fossil fuels. You know, everything that we do, transportation, communications, trade, agriculture, our lifestyle, all depend on energy. And energy demand is going up very fast as we all try to develop in this particular way. But the supply is not going the same way. And global warming is only one more reason to address this energy challenge urgently. Now, the governments did decide to control greenhouse gases. The Framework Convention on Climate Change signed in 1992, all the countries signed up to a framework convention to do something about climate change. And the Kyoto Protocol was supposed to be the first step, reducing greenhouse gas emissions back to 1990 levels by 2012, which seemed like a very limited target. It was 5% of what's needed, but we need to do 60% or more. It was a small first step in this really larger process. However, CO2 emissions rose 4.5% in 2004 to 27.5 billion tons, 26% higher than 1990. We're not going back there again. We're going the other direction pretty quickly. China and India have doubled CO2 production since 1990. The U.S., which is already the biggest emitter, increased it by 20%, and Australia by 40%. So, in spite of good intentions, we're still going very rapidly in the wrong direction. And fossil fuel energy is still growing. Oil use is growing globally at 1.1% per year, Latin America 2.9%, India 5.4%, China 7.5% a year. So by 2020, we expect to see growth resides 56%. With overproduction doubling, because the rest of the world is already producing as much oil as it possibly can. And this oil provides 40% of our primary energy. And this, of course, there's all the poor people who still don't have electricity, don't have any access to energy apart from the wood they can cut, you know, in the shrubs around their house or the dung they can get from their animals. So there's an enormous unmet demand to meet even the most basic needs. So energy demand and global warming are on a collision course, which is not a very pleasant prospect to look at. But of course, in any case, it can't go on for too long, because fossil fuels are inherently limited. You know, only so much got trapped there in the past, and we're using it very quickly. According to the best figures I was able to find from both oil industry sources and other sources, the reserves are projected to last about 40 years at present consumption rates. Not what they're projecting to happen at present consumption rates. Gas, 67 years, coal, 164 years. Geologists have generally estimated that the recoverable oil reserve is 2,000 billion barrels, but we've already used 980 billion. We know the reserves that we already know are there, 827 billion. They know we can probably still find places that we haven't had a chance to look yet. But so they're still, but they're already projecting future discoveries, 150 billion. So we've already consumed half of the available oil in the ground in less than 100 years. Now, they have demonstrated that once the first part of the oil is easiest to get out of the ground, the last half is the hardest to get. It takes the most effort and costs the most to get out. So once you reach peak production, inevitably, production starts to decline. No matter how much money you throw at it, it's just harder to get it out. So we were expected to reach that peak production globally between, say, 2008-2012, which is not very far from now. It could be a little bit longer, but the figures vary. But we're getting very, very close. And after that, production will fall nearly 3% a year, dropping 75% in 30 years. So no matter what we do, we've got to stop using oil. This is not going to be enough left to use in the relatively short time frame. Now, there are the Athabasca tar sands in Canada. There are the heavy oils, the tonic oils in Venezuela that they talk about. They're already starting to develop. But even those would only add 22 years to our current consumption level. You know, not very much in any significant terms. So even without global warming, we've got to change our energy sources and our consumption patterns. Coal also has a very significant global warming effect. And last year, the major coal-producing and consuming countries, U.S., Australia, Japan, Korea, India, China, formed their own partnership. They weren't going to do Kyoto. They were going to do their own thing, another way, on clean development and climate. And there, nearly half the world population consume nearly half the world's energy, produce more than half the CO2, and these are both expected to double by 2025. And so they agreed to share their technologies, partly to get cleaner production, but particularly saying, well, we can't stop burning it. It's inevitable. We just have to keep living this way. Therefore, we have to sort of hide the CO2 somewhere. Let's bury it in the ground or the bottom of the ocean, sequester it someplace to get it out of the atmosphere and try to stop global warming. Of course, that will make an enormous new economic opportunity for companies specializing in sequestered carbon, so they can make much more money out of us by this very expensive process of trying to do something with the CO2 that we generate. And it's partly to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but much more importantly, secure their energy supplies. They're just concerned about the future. Because China is planning to build 650 new coal-fired power stations using their very dirty, low-grade coal. India has projects to build 213 new coal-fired power stations, when the total coal reserves of India aren't expected to last more than 45 years. So they're building plants that will have useful lives far beyond even their own reserves of fuel. So, you know, there's nothing that's slowing them down yet. This is another part of this runaway process that's going to create significant increase in global warming. So just looking sort of roughly, how much of our electricity comes from these fossil fuels? Well, you can see on the graph at the left, the amount of coal, oil, and gas is most of it. Renewable biomass is a tiny little bit. Nuclear, it's a bit more than oil, but not as much as gas. Hydro, not much at the bottom. If you take out the fossil fuels, what does that leave us? Not very much at the present time. And yet we depend on these fuels for our road transport, shipping, aviation. You know, you got here. I'm sure almost all of you use quite a bit of fossil fuel to get here. That's my great sin, my footprint, because I do travel too much around the world. I try everywhere else, otherwise, to live more ecologically, but unfortunately one can't do much in the present society about air travel when you're working. But even all of our chemical industry, all of our synthetic fabrics, all of that comes from petroleum. Most industrial production uses energy, grows raw materials from these various, you know, agricultural fertilizers. The whole modern industrial agriculture depends on fertilizers that are made from natural gas, you know, wind powered from fossil fuels. All the tractors are running on fossil fuels, and therefore, what's going to happen to agriculture if suddenly it becomes much more expensive to provide all those inputs? The pesticides and all of that as well, all of that's made, you know, from petroleum products. Electricity generation, as I said, heating and cooling, lighting. Our towns, our cities have all been designed around the automobile, around present forms of transport. How will you get from the suburbs to downtown London if you can't drive there anymore, if there's no buses running anymore? Los Angeles, what would happen to Los Angeles if you don't have the automobile? A city where everybody can sit in front seats. We have to sit in the back seat. There are enough cars in that city that everybody, the whole population can sit just in the front seats of cars. The process of restructuring, those communities that still have medieval town centers can probably come back to living on foot, and so on and so forth. But not many places, can do that anymore. And, of course, the whole global trade system. Your bananas from Costa Rica, your grapes from South Africa. The whole distribution depends on this transport around the world. And if suddenly transport becomes more difficult and more expensive, how much of it will still be economical to do it that way? So it's, everything is linked in one way or another. We're looking at a whole integrated system that is looking extremely, extremely vulnerable. And of course, tourism, one of the most significant global industries, is highly sensitive to energy costs. How are you going to fly to Mallorca, get to Mallorca to lie on that beach or whatever? And the business community is very worried. There's this carbon disclosure project where more than half of the world's investors, sort of assets, send a questionnaire now each year, this year to 2,100 companies, to disclose their investment-related greenhouse gas emissions. And the results of this year's survey are going to be announced this coming Monday morning by Al Gore. This is becoming a big thing. What does this mean? Who is vulnerable to greenhouse gas emissions and what they're doing to the global climate? So it's becoming personal business as well. And looked at even very generally, 80% of all energy comes from fossil fuels, which you've got to stop burning if you know anything about climate change. The world's population has expanded sixfold, exactly in parallel with oil production.
we've been able to maintain this world population because we've been able to subsidize it with cheap energy to produce the food for all those people, to get the food places where they can't grow it locally, and so on and so forth. Can we maintain this population level without the cheap energy from fossil fuels? And if not, what's going to happen? These are big unanswered questions. And of course, then there's a question that energy planners never ask. Even if we could exploit every fossil fuel reservoir, which they're planning to do, obviously, can we really afford to cause so much global warming? The science is telling us that something is very seriously wrong, and the economics is saying that we really better start looking at it much more seriously. But people say there's a nuclear option. We could always go to nuclear power. Uranium reserves are expected to be exhausted in 40 years, which is less than the lifetime of most nuclear power plants. It's been highly subsidized by the military. There's a lot of energy input in building power plants and in making the fuel for power plants, so it's not always so carbon-free as it looks. Nobody wants to insure it in case of accidents because the risk is so high. In general, they haven't calculated how much it costs to decommission a power plant after its useful life. Leave it to the generations to worry about. But, for instance, the Three Mile Island plant in America, where there was a minor nuclear accident, was going to cost between $3 and $4 billion to decommission. So this is not some small figure that doesn't count very much. Here in the UK, when they privatized electricity, nobody wanted to touch the nuclear part of it. It was not interesting to the private sector. And, of course, the costs of waste disposal are imposed on generations because nobody yet knows how to safely dispose of the stuff, and it's got to be kept safe from all contact with life for 10,000 years, 20,000 years. So again, sort of putting off on our children and our grandchildren and future generations much of the costs of this kind of generation. There's, of course, fusion power. Well, it's been 40 years off for the last 50 years. It's still 40 years off. So maybe someday, but we probably shouldn't count on it for the moment. And, of course, as the UK Met Office said recently, the biggest obstacles to taking up technologies of renewable energy or even clean coal lie in vested interests, cultural barriers to change, and a simple lack of awareness. Dealing with this problem goes far beyond simple technical scientific solutions. So, do we go back to life without fossil fuels? Or can we rethink civilization in some new and better way? Where do we go from here with this kind of a situation? And that's where standing back and looking at more from a faith-based perspective can help us to put things in a larger context, going from the immediate issues of climate change and global warming down through the different levels of the way our society functions. First, looking at our present economic system and what it's failing to do, and then what may be solutions, alternative approaches to the problem, and some ethical principles that might help us to go in the right direction in the years ahead. And I think, as Tony Blair recently commented, no politician is ready to sacrifice the short-term economic welfare of his people, even though he may well agree that sustainability is essential in the long term. Yes, we must have sustainable development. We all will sign on to that. But we can't do anything with the economy now. That's just too important for the next election. And, of course, there are these deep social divisions within societies and between countries that prevent us from taking united action in the common interest. If you're not a united society, are you going to work together to face a problem like this? This makes it very difficult. And, of course, global warming is just one symptom of the fundamental imbalances in our world today. There are many other problems that are also extremely important and equally threatening. And our economic system is incapable of addressing this kind of global long-term issue. There's just no decision-making processes at the global level to handle those kinds of questions. So global warming underlines the failure of our present economic system, which is challenged by this kind of environmental crisis. It doesn't know what to do with it. It doesn't seem to fit with its frame of reference. And, of course, economics has been based on this belief that there's no limit to nature's capacity to fulfill any demand made on it. That's been one of the foundations of economic thinking. You don't cost natural resources. They're free for the taking. There's always going to be more, so we can grow forever. And, perpetual economic growth is part of the mantra of economics. But our culture, which gives absolute value to expansion, to growth, to acquisition, to getting more, invisible hand of self-interest. You know, I'm going to get rich and it's good for the country. And the satisfaction of people's wants has to recognize these goals are not realistic guides to policy in a world that's facing these kinds of threats and challenges. And economic decision-making tools just can't cope with this. You know, there's no way to bring that into the frame of reference of the multinational corporations or national economic players as they're working in the world today. And so we might say that this climate change is a consequence of this dominant, self-centered materialism of our present Western society. And this is, in fact, you know, when you talk about what can religion do, well, the religion of the 20th century was materialism. You know, most people, you know, they may still pay lip service or something, but they really, the religion they live in their values every day is a kind of, you know, materialism, a very materialistic view of our purpose in life, purpose in society. And the assumption was that rational scientific thought and experimentation could solve all of the problems of human governance and development. And in fact, it's become so powerful that it has seized all kinds of political, economic power and media power. And there's no way today you could easily challenge this process of making more and more money at the global level. You know, the machinery is just, you know, taken over and is going away and is, you know, running without control. There's no international legislation that can control the known decision-making mechanisms that can, you know, bring it under control. And no way to even be a voice in the wilderness. So, I was very surprised, it's a slightly different context, but in America at the time of the Iraq War, I met a priest from Ireland, he's visiting America, and he came back and he said he just couldn't believe it. At that time, all the major Christian churches were against the idea of the war, and they couldn't say so. The media wouldn't give them any airtime. Everything was just sort of locked up. Only one thing could be said, and even the mainline churches were voiceless in that situation. And this is, you know, it sort of illustrates how much information itself is managed for the benefit of the economic system, of those who are using it to continue to create more and more wealth in their particular context and framework. So we have to admit, we've been trying to develop, and of course this is looking beyond, you know, the wealthy countries, we've been trying to develop the rest of the world, because of the problem of poverty, since World War II. And it's been an enormous undertaking. You know, billions and billions, hundreds of billions of dollars have been spent with very good goals, trying to help the poor peoples of the world, trying to bring development to everybody. And we haven't narrowed the gap. There are still, you know, billions of people who don't have even the basics. I'm always, you know, shocked when I sort of think that, you know, nearly half the world's population is trying to live on less money than the European Union spends to subsidize every cow in the European Union. You know, so cows are worth more than people. So, you know, it's, you know, the contrast between the rich and the poor, and that gap has widened to an abyss. It's not gotten better, it's gotten worse. So, you know, development has failed to do what it set out to do. It's been very good for a small minority. So we might say this is our modern consumer culture. This is what's being sold around the world. Everybody's goal in life is to become developed, like they show in Hollywood films or Bollywood films or whatever. This gospel of human betterment is, you know, chasing after a bigger car, you know, the next cell phone, you know, the next brand name on your tennis shoes, you know, or whatever, in order to keep the economy going. And so us, the small minority who can afford to live that way, you know, really enjoy the benefits. It's quite comfortable to live this way. It's really neat. You know, why not? And why apologize about it? You know, we did it. It's our economy. And this is the way people think. You know, I've earned it. I have the right to live this way. You know, well and good. But the result, of course, is with the breakdown of traditional morality, that people turned away from traditional religions, is that everything is driven by the most base elements of human nature, the animal impulse. You know, how much sex do you see in advertising? I was sitting in a small cafe in a rural part of Bulgaria. This big poster on the wall of a nearly naked woman holding a chainsaw. It was an advertisement for some brand of chainsaws. And so, of course, they wanted to get those, you know, those lumberjacks out there to buy this brand of chainsaw because they were attracted to the sex symbol, you know, behind it on the wall. And everything is sold through using these very base appetites. And, in fact, when we look at at society today, selfishness has become a prized commercial resource. Everything is based on playing to people's selfish interests. Greed, lust, indolence, pride, these things that used to be criticized in the churches as something bad have become something of social and economic value. Everything is based on that, encouraged, because it can build the market. Even violence is sold because it attracts people to television, and you see more and more extreme forms of violence because that's what keeps the viewers coming. If there's no violence, they zap to the other channel where they can find something more stimulating. And yet at the same time, the more we get these material things, the less real meaning or value they have. And you look in America, the GDP has kept going up, and this wonderful development they've had over the last 50 years. You look at measures of human welfare satisfaction, and it sort of leveled out in the 1960s and has been going down since. So yes, the economy has been going up. Doesn't mean that people are happy or are living better, getting any real satisfaction from what's been happening. There's a disjunct between what our economy is doing and what people are really getting from it. And this self-centered hedonistic culture of the rich that we're now spreading around the world and selling everywhere, the elites want to live the same way. This is the goal everybody's setting. All the Chinese want to have a car now. Now, what's that going to mean when you get 1.3 billion people driving cars, in terms of global warming, assuming we have enough petrol to put in the tanks? There are some serious disjuncts here between what we're selling and what is possible. But they're refusing to acknowledge their responsibility for global warming. This illness is spiritual, basically. And, we look at, how does this relate to the faith-based perspective, there's this progressive globalization of human experience. Whereas before, we used to be content living in our village, in our town, going to the church, or whatever. Today, immediately what's happening all around the world. You can pick up your cell phone and call just about anybody on the planet who has a cell phone. A disaster happens somewhere and it's on the television news immediately. Everybody knows about it. So human experience is mobilizing, and we can no longer tolerate the differences that we did before. We're much more aware of what we have and what they don't have, or vice versa. And so, this increases the social stresses and strains on society. And at the same time, those people who are pursuing the moralistic ideal are beginning to lose faith. So maybe this wasn't such a good idea. They're midlife changes, questioning whether it was worth making some sacrifices, to do so well, asking if we shouldn't go in some other direction, trying to, because they become conscious of how negative a certain aspect of their lifestyle have become. At the same time, they don't see in traditional religions the kind of guidance they need to live in the modern world. But they want to find some explanation, some understanding of why they're here and what's happening. And, of course, the result is you get this resurgence of religion driven more by anxiety and discontent, with a spiritual emptiness. But people who are desperate and are looking are particularly vulnerable to fanatical extreme movements, whether they be nationalistic, racial, intolerant, and so on. Just think of what happened with Hitler in the 1930s, The problem after World War I, people were desperate, and they were easily swept along with what he promised, what he proposed. And so, we're becoming increasingly unstable, in terms of the social situation around the world because of this process. And it's even becoming a point where people are arguing maybe beginning a war of civilizations because of the extreme polarization taking place among different religious groups around the world. And of course, in that situation, when you're sort of paralyzed on the verge of civil war, can you easily address a global challenge like climate change? How do you say, we've got to do something to save the climate? We're about to cut you at our throats, and so on and so forth. This is paralyzing us in terms of any kind of action to address such common global issues. So we're sort of at a crossroads. So either we can choose business as usual in our society and ignore the future, sort of let it happen. Oh, that's just too bad. Or that those of us retreat back to a fortress world of old values, lock ourselves in our castles, and forget about the rest of the world. But that's not necessarily a sustainable solution either. Most castles fail sooner or later to the end of it. Or do we make a transition to some more sustainable world by bringing the science and religion back into harmony? Those are the challenges, alternatives that we face today. So, looked at from a faith-based perspective, because all the faiths have talked about the importance of unity. That's what religion, the word religion means, tie together, unite. Therefore, we have to, if we want to address our collective destiny, if we want to come together, we have to start it on the basis of unity. That's the fundamental transformation that must take place if we want to begin to address these problems. But talking about, everybody says, oh yes, it would be nice to have unity. You know, we all believe in unity in some sense. The United Nations is there for that. Oh. But nobody really carries on down to say, what does this really mean in terms of changing our behavior, changing how our countries behave to each other and all the rest of it? Because it's a fundamental challenge to the way our institutions function. We live in a society that's based on conflict, competition. Everything is conflictual. And this is also, it comes from the same idea, survival of the fittest, dominance, it's the Darwinian 19th century set of values. And that's, these, it might say, the scientific views and the economic views have come together to reinforce this view of things that are preventing us from going forward. But only something that starts at that basic level of saying we must acknowledge that we're all part of a single human race would allow us to address these problems of ethnic and religious strife that are becoming so prominent in the world today and in which we're particularly vulnerable. And it's only if we can get people to recognize that we're living on that single planet Earth, that we're all part of one human family, we'll be able to create, it might say, an ethical, moral basis for making the changes that allow us to begin to move ahead with problems like climate change. As Baha'u'llah, the founder of the Baha'i faith, put it, the well-being of mankind is peace and security are unattainable unless until its unity is firmly established. So that process of building unity has to come first. That is the foundation level from which you can then say, with this unity, how do we address these challenges that we're creating for ourselves in the environmental area? And, of course, governments, in a sense, have already agreed to this concept, in a sense, when they talked about sustainable development, which, of course, was adopted first by the Brundtland Commission for the United Nations in 1987 as development that meets the needs of the present generation without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. So that's exactly what climate change is about. Climate change, global warming, is compromising the ability of future generations to meet their needs. We're creating enormous problems for the future. So any move to sustainable development requires that we address and solve this fundamental problem, which is why at the same time that the governments signed up to Agenda 21, the Action Plan for Sustainable Development in 1992, they also signed the Framework Convention on Climate Change to deal with that issue. So governments have accepted this as something we must act on. Not that they're doing it, but they said we must do it. And it's been set as a goal and priority. The challenge is, how do we get there? And when you look at sustainability, it's really an ethical concept.
Thank you.
We are trustees of this planet. We do have to, take care of its resources. We can't, it's not just taking care of itself anymore. We're interfering with it at all different levels. We have to manage these resources with, justice and equity long into the future. We can't be looking at a 5-year time scale or even a 100-year time scale. You can see where those curves were going. We need to be looking at sustainability, over hundreds of thousands of years. We're going to achieve some kind of balance in the long term. Which means that we have to look at the environmental impacts of everything that we do. The economy can no longer ignore, the economic impacts. We also recognize that principles like moderation and humility that you don't often see in economic discourse today may need to come back into our discussion. And nature has other values than economic values. So that fundamentally, we have to learn to take care of this. This is not just some discretionary thing, or we can take care of the environment after we've developed economically, but that this is a fundamental responsibility for our spiritual development as physical survival. Both our spiritual and our physical natures are seriously threatened by what we're now doing with these problems of unsustainability. So when we look, we have to rethink economics. We have to change the economic system. That's clearly what's driving us in the wrong direction. But it's not the mechanism of economics that are the problem, it's the values that underlie it. And so we need a new kind of economics. And Augusto Lopez Flores will talk more about this tomorrow. But we need an economics that does, goes beyond this corrosive materialism and has allowed persistent poverty to persist to an economics that can serve people's needs and then allow us to fulfill our own real purpose for development, which is the cultivation of an latent in human consciousness. This is not a material goal development. This is an intellectual, a cultural, a social, and spiritual goal that we need to set for ourselves for development. And economics has to then fit within that new and broader framework. So we need new value-based economic models that aim for a dynamic, just, and thriving social order, that are strongly altruistic and cooperative in nature, that can provide meaningful employment, which is one of the major problems at the present time, that can eradicate poverty, and that can allow us to accept responsibility for and address problems like global warming. And, of course, the values underlying this change, when you come down to what have all religions taught us, the golden rule, do unto others as you would have others do unto you, does a tiny minority of high-energy consumers have the right to cause such damage to others in future generations? And many faith-based people are drawing attention to the fact that what we're doing with our consumption of energy at the rate we're doing it now has enormous ethical implications, and that really must be addressed much more than is being in society. So we need to look at the principles like justice and equity, that it's unjust to sacrifice the well-being, the generality of humankind, or even of the planet itself, as seems to be happening, to the advantages which technological breakthroughs can make available to privileged minorities like us. Because we're all using computers and cell phones and so on. We've got lots of advantages. We use lots of energy to get here. We need more solidarity, because the poor are the most vulnerable to climate change. They're able to protect themselves. So we have to see every human being as a trust of the whole. That, yes, we need to create wealth, but wealth to make everybody wealthy, not just for, privileged few. And to do that, therefore, there should be a voluntary process of sharing. The communists tried to impose equalization from the top, and it didn't work. So only a motivation that comes from the ethical level, from the individual, each person, can really bring about the kind of fundamental changes that are needed. We need more cooperation and reciprocity, because I see this as a biologist in ecological systems. The higher the system has evolved, the more you see symbiosis working together, replacing strict competition, in the operation of the system. And it's the same, with human systems. And this will be necessary if we're going to find solutions to global warming. We need to be able to trust each other. I mean, the people who need to act today are the politicians and business leaders. Who trusts our politicians and our business leaders? Any survey that's done of who do you trust in society, way down there at the bottom, are those particular categories. So reestablishing trust, becoming trustworthy, must be part of creating a system in which we, in fact, can work together to address such challenges. And then, as I mentioned earlier, this question of moderation. As Baha'u'llah said, the civilization so often vaunted by the learned exponents of arts and sciences will, if allowed to overleap the bounds of moderation, bring great evil upon men. The day is approaching when its flame will devour the cities. Now, I don't know whether that flame is just a metaphor for global warming. It's going to get hotter and hotter, or what. But in any case, our civilization has gone to an excess, and the result of that is this process of transformation now taking place at the planetary level. So we have to start with ourselves. And all faiths have taught the spiritual value of a simple life and desire for material things. Be content with little. Be freed from all inordinate desire. So that would be the place to start when trying to bring down energy consumption. Do I have to buy that? Do I need this? Do I want something more? Regardless of the energy cost. And climate change is one issue on which all religions can find common ground. In 1995, I was sent by the United Nations to a World Summit on Religions and Conservation at Windsor Castle. Prince Philip was the host for it. And there was the Archbishop of Canterbury, and the Rabbi from Jerusalem, and the Lord Bishop from London, and the Vice President of the World Council of Jews, and the World Council of Churches, and the Vice President of the World Taoist Association of China, and Rui Kanim, the leading Baha'i dignitary, for 4 days debating these issues. And they all agreed. All the religions, he said, in this area, our principles are the same. We must be responsible. We must work together. So this is an area where, in fact, we can do a lot in interfaith collaboration, in interfaith work, because there is a commonality there for everybody working together. And therefore, we need to look much more at these values for sustainable society. Justice, solidarity, altruism, respect, trust, moderation, service. These are the foundations on which each decision that we take about addressing global warming and climate change can help to guide us forward. Not that we know all the answers, but if we incorporate these values into our own lives, into the lives of the institutions that we build in society, then we can find our way forward and in the many different ways we need around the world to address this issue more fundamentally. And therefore, religion can strengthen the ethical framework for action on climate change. It can educate people about the values and global responsibility that are needed. It can create motivation for change and can encourage necessary sacrifices. And global warming and the resulting climate change challenge is challenging us in fundamental ways. Science alone is not going to solve the problem. And the rest of this weekend, hope that we can explore the ways in which we can start at the ethical level and bring it together with what we know about the science of climate change and figure out where do we go from here, individually and collectively. Thank you very much.